again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Kimmy Addie Dokin.
It was really just this huge victory and both launching pad and turning point for they've won the battle of public opinion by far. And
coming up, we'll hear a panel presentation of Chicago Teachers Union strike of 2012 and its impacts on the Chicago political scene.
What I narrate in this book, which covers the years 1973 to 1976, is a kind of a debate going on within the culture about this new vision of patriotism, about challenging our leaders.
And we'll also hear from the author of The Invisible Bridge about the politics of the 1970s and their impacts on the present day. But first, here are some headlines from the Indy Media Network in Chicago and around the world. Ireland Indy Media reported on a planned transatlantic free trade treaty. A feature dated November 26, 2014, reported on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, abbreviated TTIP, and the treaty's potential repercussions. Quoting one example, in 2010, the U.S. mining and gas company Renco managed to successfully avoid having to pay compensation to Peruvian locals who were harmed due to pollution by their companies by successfully using a provision of the Peru-U.S. trade agreement. Not satisfied with having to pay compensation, the company has since demanded $800 million from the Peruvian government, as they argue that one of the companies they own, Doe Run, was forced into bankruptcy due to an expensive pollution cleanup which the Peruvian government required Doe Run to conduct. Such strong-arm tactics are bound to escalate on both sides of the Atlantic if the TTIP treaty is allowed to go into effect. Independent media centers worldwide have chronicled some of the many protests locally regarding the Michael Brown and Eric Garner grand jury rulings in late 2014. Here is a sampling of the coverage. The Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center reported on a diverse group representing campus and community, black, white, and brown, young and old, chanted, sang poetry, and marched in a circle of hope between the Champaign County Courthouse and the Sheriff's Office and County Jail. In Atlanta in August, three demonstrations took place well before the outcome of the grand jury proceedings were released. At the first demonstration, around 200 people rallied in Decatur Square with a group comprised mostly of African-American students, activists, and others. At the second demonstration, between 1,000 to 3,000 people marched, featured speeches, and ended in the crowd marching around the Centennial Olympic Park. The third and final demonstration, in August 2014, took place at West End Park, with a group of about 300 blocking traffic and intersections along the way. Puerto Rico Indy Media reported on the grand jury decision, noting statistics on police brutality towards African Americans and protests taking place in the U.S. In Portland, two Ferguson solidarity marches took place, noting two activists were singled out by police and arrested. Boston Indy Media reported on anti-police violence protesters that took over downtown Boston on December 4th, and a Ferguson Solidarity March in Boston that took place on November 26, where youth leaders and the community shut down the streets. East Bay Indy Media reported on protests across the Bay Area in Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose, and Berkeley, mostly in the form of marches, with one San Jose protest shutting down traffic. And in Chicago, activists took over and blocked Lakeshore Drive on multiple occasions. Protesters also occupied Chicago City Hall and evaded arrests at the last possible moment. A Chicago protest on December 13, 2014, dubbed Millions March Shy, took over downtown with marches and die-in protests. Police repression followed with some two dozen arrests, including two arrests on felony charges. Rochester Indy Media reported on another case of police exoneration after an apparent police assault of a disabled elderly black man. On May 1, 2013, Benny War, an African-American man in a wheelchair with a prosthetic leg, was waiting for a bus on Jefferson Avenue in Rochester. At the time, police were conducting a sweep of the street to clear the block of any groups hanging out, at the behest of an association of local businesses. Benny Ward was caught in this sweep and was ordered to move by two Rochester police officers, Joseph Ferrigno and Anthony Liberatore. Ward explained that he was waiting for an approaching bus. The officers, as confirmed by cell phone videos, surveillance videos, and eyewitness testimony, yelled at Ward, sprayed him in the face with pepper spray, pushed him out of his wheelchair, and repeatedly punched and kicked Ward. Despite the abundance of evidence accusing the police of assaulting Ward, the official Rochester police investigation of the incident could be charitably characterized as incompetent. The independent witnesses were not contacted. Investigators played hard and loose with facts raised by surveillance footage and relied solely on police testimony to arrive at its decision, despite contradictory police statements. In January 2015, an attorney representing Benny Ward went to court to demand the release of personnel files and other police documents. Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Because you know I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books, start reading. I'm all about those books. Yeah, it's pretty clear that I am really cool. Because I'm reading, reading, it's what I like to do. Cause I got that fiction that everyone chasing. All of these books take you so many places. I see those magazines, they making reading hard. They're great when time is short and you can even swap. If you got books or Kindles, just raise them up. Cause anything you read is perfect from the start until the stop. Yeah, Devon said she told me don't worry about the size. She says good read is like lots of books to read a night. You know I won't be no closed-minded, blank-looking Barbie doll. So if that's what you're into, then go ahead and move along.
On December 6th, 2014, Columbia College in Chicago played host to the Chicago Book Expo, which featured authors and panels of discussions on a variety of topics, including a number of topics regarding local politics and activism. We'll hear two of these panels in this episode of From the Trenches. We'll begin with a panel about the Chicago Teachers Union strike and its impacts, including those of the 2015 Chicago elections. The panel featured journalist Michael Utrecht, author of the book Strike for America, Chicago Teachers Against Austerity, and Carrie Leiderson, author of the book Mayor 1%, Rahm Emanuel and the Rise of Chicago's 99%. The panel was moderated by Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stepinchik.
So let's begin, and probably about the thrust of this presentation, the Chicago Teacher Strike, which took place, as everyone here no doubt knows, in September of 2012, running for about a week. There were some obvious impacts that the strike has had. But I'd like to talk about some of the lesser known but still nonetheless very positive impacts. Can you mention any, for example?
Sure. So my book, Strike for America, is the beginning of it. People know about the Chicago Teachers Union in Chicago and elsewhere because of the 2012 strike. But part of the story I tell in the book is the sort of internal struggle that took place within the union for literally, you know, a decade or over a decade before the 2012 strike was anywhere on the radar. And a big part of the book is talking about this the idea of sort of what unions are and what they're for in American society. When people talk about the labor movement, specifically, usually it's sort of from the right wing, there's this kind of monolithic idea of what a union does. All unions act this way and do this. There's just the sort of one way that unions operate. But really, in American labor history, there is this long struggle between differing visions of unions within unions themselves. Do unions exist solely to gain better contracts for their members, better benefits and better pay? Maybe if you get in trouble at work, then the union representative, you call them up and they can come help you out. That's the limit of what your union is for. In order to make things better for you and your coworkers, you've got a union who sort of takes care of the stuff for you. And it doesn't sort of go beyond your workplace or union membership, right? That's one sort of vision of unionism in American history. But it's always been challenged from the left by an idea that often is referred to as social movement unionism, which is a social justice unionism. The unions don't just exist to win better pay and better contracts and better benefits for their members, but that they are about creating a movement that can benefit the entire working class, all working people, right? Just as within unions in American society, there's been this fight ever since the dawn of American unionism. This is central to understanding what's happened in the Chicago Teachers Union over the last several years. Unions are supposed to be democratic institutions where the members, people who pay dues, then elect their leadership. Within the CTU, there's been since the 1960s, there's been these sort of fights within the union between different caucuses representing different visions. And the story I tell in the book is about how a caucus was referred to as the United Progressive Caucus, the UPC, which was a racial justice caucus within that union, who was fighting for African-American teachers and Latino teachers who were victims of racial discrimination in Chicago public schools. For example, African-American teachers were, many of them, or almost all of them, couldn't become full-time teachers. They were full-time basis substitutes, or FTDs, they were referred to. And so these people who were within the union were working to change this, right? And one example of sort of racial justice work within the union. But over time, this leadership within the union grew increasingly conservative, increasingly unwilling to fight the kinds of free market-based education reforms that were happening in the city. And so the short story is telling how this old guard, rank-and-file members within the union looked to reform the union, there was a reform attempt at first that was this sort of top-down reformism that didn't see any kind of changed relationship with the membership of the union. There were people who said, this old leadership is corrupt, they're inept, they're not carrying out the kind of agenda that we want them to carry out. Elect us, and we will do a better job of it in 2001 under a caucus that was called PACT. That top-down reform effort failed, which led to a sort of different vision of unionism that was represented by a group that was eventually referred to as the Caucus of Rank and File Educators Corps, which formed in 2000. Around end of 2008, early 2009, took over the union in 2010. This is the union, the caucus that Karen Lewis is a part of, and the leadership of the CTU is a part of. And so this may all sound like sort of insider baseball. Who would care about internal squabbles within a union, except people like us who have an unhealthy obsession with the labor movement, probably. But the significance of it is that there are these differing visions for what unions should be about, the reason that the CTU would be able to go on strike in 2012, the reason that the CTU is the institution that we know it as today, is because these people with this broader, more progressive, sort of democratic vision of what a union should be about, one, took over the union in 2010. Without that, there is no 2012 teacher strike. There is no possibility, a former possibility of Karen Lewis running for mayor. There is not this massive kind of energy that we have in the city of Chicago, around which an education justice and a broad progressive movement have coalesced around this union. None of that happens without this internal fight within the union. That actually wasn't the question that you asked me, but I wanted to start with that just to understand how we got to where we are today. It's based on these competing visions of of unions as vehicles for broader social justice in the city of Chicago.
Yeah, so for, well, thanks for having us.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of positive impacts of the teacher's strike, just to build off what Micah said, I mean, in terms of the actual contracts and the situation in the schools, I mean, the teachers did, you know, more or less sort of win the strike and come out, I'm sure not with everything they would have wanted. I mean, that's a whole other discussion of all the things that are wrong with the public schools and the lack of funding and all that. But, you know, they actually did kind of win the strike in terms of getting, you know, beating back some of the things that the mayor and the appointed school board wanted in their contract. But then much more importantly, like Micah was saying, it was really just this huge victory and both launching pad and turning point for, they won the battle of public opinion by far. And, you know, this symbolized much larger things about Mayor Emanuel in particular, and about sort of the vision of municipal governance. And, you know, it was on a national stage, it was a period where the majority of the public in Chicago voiced their, not only voiced, but also showed in the streets their support for the teachers union and for the concept of organized labor, fighting for their rights, and for the concept of public education at a time when the very, you know, idea of public education was under attack and was being privatized. And this, it was a really a symbol of, you know, in the national school reform, battle over school reform and charter schools and all that. So the fact that this strike happened and that there was such overwhelming public support for the teachers was huge and was really just the start, or not, I mean, it wasn't the start, but it was helped elevate and mobilize, you know, what has continued to be a movement, including now with the, you know, the mayoral race and what started out as Karen Lewis's candidacy and now Chuy Garcia's candidacy, and more generally a movement against Rahm Emanuel and what he represents. The teacher's strike was really integral to that. So, I mean, it was, you know, we could talk more about all these issues, but it was huge in that respect.
Yeah. You know, kind of diving into along what both of you had said regarding the kind of fact that Rahm Emanuel had basically been the face of the grand enemy that was posed as that the labor movement and that the Chicago Teachers Union and that really the public, including actually the public nationally and internationally, all rallied against. And that kind of leads me to what happened the following year when Rahm Emanuel had announced the closing of what wound up being the largest school closings in American history. 48, I believe, was the final number that was tallied. Chicago public schools were closed in what was, you know, always billed as a kind of, you know, cost-saving measure to help to, you know, save the students and to address pressing budget needs. But nonetheless, which I probably will never get the evidence about this, but the part of me in the back of my mind will always think that that was probably a revenge move by Rahm Emanuel against the teachers union, precisely for the effective strike and for the fact that Rahm Emanuel was probably got the biggest PR blow maybe in his entire life as a result of that. So I guess my question to you is, do you think, or is there evidence to suggest or maybe confirm that those closings were a kind of revenge move by Rahm for the effectiveness of that strike in 2012? Is there any way to know or say? Anyone know? Can anyone comment?
I'm sure it was really convenient that he was able to take that kind of revenge, but I'm sure it was planned long even before the strike and, you know, as part of this larger, I mean, the whole reason that Rahm worked to get a law that he thought would prevent the teachers from striking, the state law that was supposed to make it impossible for them to strike, but they nonetheless had such overwhelming support within their membership that they were able to. Anyway, I mean, I think, mm-hmm. So not to say that it wasn't revenge, but I don't think he just cooked that up, you know, all of a sudden to take revenge. I mean, it would be less disturbing even if that were the case, but the more disturbing and, you know, reality is that it's part of this larger vision for dismantling public education and just public spending and, you know, disinvesting in neighborhoods that, not that he particularly hated those neighborhoods and wanted to ruin them, but, you know, a shifting of resources and really, like, what you could call the austerity agenda. I mean, I think it's all just really part of that. And, you know, I'm sure even better that I'm sure he would have done it even if the teachers hadn't gone on strike. But, you know, even better that he was able to kind of stick it to them with that. And then, I mean, I think what's really upsetting also about the school closing in terms of the public relations aspect, I mean, it was, I guess, a public relations disaster for ROM at the time, and it did get, you know, probably international attention, and I mean, the local media coverage did a pretty good job of showing just how much passionate opposition there was to the school closings. But, I mean, he's pretty much weathered it. You know, they went through with the closings. The violence that was expected didn't exactly happen. You know, there weren't, like, real horror stories of violence directly related to the school closings. There were a couple things. But, you know, that was sort of like the angle that, I guess, I mean, it was a valid concern, but, you know, to me, the more serious issues is the ongoing, it's kind of like the death by a thousand paper cuts, you know, just the ongoing impacts of not having those schools and of the way the school closings dismantled communities and networks. You know, that's not like the sexy kind of thing that makes headlines like, you know, like violence does. So, I mean, unfortunately, I think that, and Ram was smart. I'm sure he planned it from day one to do the closings, you know, fairly well in advance of the election. I think a lot of people, you know, on the ground in those communities still feel the impacts of the school closings every day and very much hold it against him. But, you know, the people who aren't in those communities and who might have been reading the headlines and upset about the school closings last year, you know, a lot of them have probably forgotten about it by this time this year. So, I mean, I hope I'm wrong about that. But, you know, I think, I mean, he's a very savvy and strategic guy. And, you know, I think he actually probably feels pretty good about how the school closings worked out at this point.
Yeah, I would say it's sort of tempting to think of them as the sort of personal retribution that's carried out by the mayor, which is the way that the strike and that a lot of the battles between Mayor Amon Bill's administration and CTU have been cast, right, at this sort of clash of these huge personalities, right, the, like, foul-mouthed mayor of a major city, you know, major Democratic power player who, like, sends people dead fish in the mail, versus, you know, the brash teachers union leader who isn't afraid to, you know, go try to tell with this guy. While they're that's certainly a sort of compelling aspect of the story of the CTU union and the administration. And what's more interesting to me is sort of what, you know, the fact that what the policies that Rahm Emanuel was trying to carry out in the 2012 contract negotiations, the school closings, all fit in with the model of education reform that has been pursued in this city for over a decade now. I mean, under Renaissance 2010, the education reform program under Arne Duncan, who was the CEO of Chicago Public Schools, you know, there were a total of, I believe, 100 schools that were closed over a period of several years. Never that many in one fell swoop, but more schools were closed over the course of the last decade than were closed in this one act in 2013. Rather than it being this kind of, retribution from one, you know, just the mayor was filled with rage that he had lost this strike. I mean, it fits in with what the agenda in the city had been around public education for a long time. As to whether he has effectively weathered those storms, I mean, you know, at the time of the strike, you know, one of the most compelling and sort of strangest statistic that came out of the CTU strike was that a Chicago Tribune poll that was done at the time, literally while the strike was going on, among CPS parents, that asked them at the exact moment when their lives are sort of put in an upheaval or they're trying to find childcare for their kids because they're not able to go to school, at this exact moment, this Trib poll found that 67% of African American and Latino parents in the city of Chicago backed this CTU over the mayor in the fight. And similar numbers have come out over, you know, school closings, there's you know, the mayor has lost the sort of public relations battle over those things, and it is not popular, especially in these neighborhoods that have been affected by these policies. So in that section, in that sense, it hasn't been a success, but I think he feels comfortable carrying out those kind of policies when he doesn't feel like anyone is really capable of capitalizing on the energy against the feeling in a lot of Chicago neighborhoods against him, and he seemed to only be really threatened by Karen Lewis when the prospect of her running for mayor was on the table. So I guess I'd just phrase it differently, that it's not that he has successfully weathered these storms, just in terms of winning over the people of Chicago. It's just that the people of Chicago, well, long felt that they don't really have anywhere else to go against a mayor who has this enormous war chest of $9 million plus to use, can pick up the phone and raise huge amounts of money in just a couple of minutes. And so there hasn't been anybody who's been willing to really step up and capitalize on that energy and effort. Which could bring us to a discussion which we'll probably get to about the Chuy Garcia's campaign for mayor. But I just wanted to make that point, that it's not like he has emerged from these things unscathed. He's a deeply unpopular person in this city.
Yeah. One fact for everyone to keep in mind, Chicago elected officials, from the mayor on down, have no term limits of any elected position. The only way you can be removed from a position of which you are elected in the city of Chicago is if you are caught up in a criminal endeavor, if you're convicted of a crime. Aside from that, you could, as many people do, be in office for quite a long time. And that's actually a very scary prospect to consider. There was a case with our previous mayor, Richard M. Daley, who had served six 4-year terms, and wound up actually surpassing his father as the longest tenured mayor in Chicago's history. Along those lines, and actually I'm glad both of you brought up Karen Lewis, who I think had emerged, former head of the Chicago Teachers Union, a longtime organizer, was involved in CORE, as I recall, and also was kind of regarded as a kind of, as was mentioned before, figurehead of the royal opposition, of this inchoate labor movement where there are their own varying strands and differences of opinion, but nonetheless had a person who could serve as a kind of figurehead of the movement, Karen Lewis, and who, for much of 2014, had apparently launched a committee for pursuing a mayoral run in Chicago in 2014, ultimately opted to bow out for health reasons. But along those lines, it seems like that the strike kind of also made this possibility of a mayor Karen Lewis reasonably viable for much of the time. And I guess the question for both Micah and for Kari here in our panel, if circumstances had been a little bit different, for example, if Karen Lewis had been a little bit healthier, do you think that she actually would have run for office, and do you think that she would have been able to win against such a entrenched and well-funded mayor? Would that have been a possibility?
Well, I think it's pretty clear she was going to run. She was planning to run, and there were polls showing that she actually had a decent chance to get the mayor into a runoff and possibly win. So, yeah, it was definitely a possibility. And really, just like we said on the first question, you can't it was just such huge significance that the strike and the school closings and everything around the public schools elevated the leader of a union in this day and age to such a prominent position that they were literally an international superstar and could actually credibly challenge someone like Rahm Emanuel. Like, that is just, Karen Lewis, it couldn't just be any head of a union. She's just such a, amazing and dynamic person that, it was her. But the fact that, it's just remarkable that, not only a president of the union, but someone who is really taking an outspoken, 99, and it was, of course, like in the post-Occupy era and all that, so the timing was great, but someone could credit, and it happened in New York, so it's not like this is the only place, but someone really talking about class war, basically, or class struggle, and talking about workers' rights as their main platform, you know, could have a chance to become mayor of Chicago. It's just amazing, and, you know, obviously tragic that that's not going to get a chance to play out. But even though Karen isn't actually in the race anymore, the larger, you know, the issues and, I mean, the dynamics are still exist, the things that her almost candidacy brought to the forefront. So.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it seemed, like Carrie said, it seemed clear that Karen was going to run. I personally was sort of didn't think she might actually stand a chance to win, but that isn't necessarily what would qualify as a successful mayoral run. I mean, the obvious point is that she'd be able to bring up all kinds of issues that the CTU has been at the forefront of in as a kind of progressive vision for the city of Chicago, but also, you know, is someone who, as the kind of figurehead of this broader progressive movement, could help bring attention and perhaps money and all kinds of things to these city council campaigns that the CTU and other community groups and unions are pushing for in the 2015 elections, which I think they have a much stronger chance of actually being able to win, of being able to pick off a sizable number of city council members who are firmly in the pocket of Rahm Emanuel. If you look at any of the city council votes on basically anything throughout the history of the recent history of Chicago, they're always sort of, well, actually, most of the political history of the city of Chicago, the votes are always, you know, 50-0, 48-2, these kind of things. And so, as the progressive caucus in the city council has started to sort of find its sea legs a little bit, and the CTU and other unions are running these campaigns for aldermen, there's a chance that those campaigns have a much better chance of actually winning than I think someone taking on Mayor Emanuel. But my point is that a campaign, whether it's through Karen Lewis or Chuy Garcia or whoever, has the opportunity to sort of amplify a lot of those campaigns, and victory could look like not necessarily winning the mayor's office, but in shifting the balance of forces on the city council.
That would probably be something we should explore a little bit more, especially since so much focus, understandably so, but a lot of the political oxygen tends to be sucked up by the mayor's race, the mayor's race, the mayor's race, and yet there are 50 aldermanic offices that are up for grabs as well. I mean, you'll have candidacies like that of Jorge Mujica, for example, who's been trying to run for an independent candidacy in the 25th Ward. Are either of you on tune with some of those, I guess, independent candidacies? And do you see what do you see as far as the possibilities of wins there? Talk about the mayoral, or excuse me, the aldermanic elections.
Well, there are several independent candidacies that you mentioned, like Jorge Mujica, who's running as an independent in 25th Ward in Pilsen, who are sort of more long shot possibilities. But the CTU has engaged in a number, including having, I think, it's four different rank and file members of the union who are running for aldermen in some neighborhoods, several of whom, which you know, it's hard to say at this point in a local race like that, but seem to be presenting a credible threat to some stalwart allies in the Emanuel administration. You know, I've been, I hung out with a campaign in Albany Park, which ward it is, but against Deb Mell, the campaign is being run by a CTU teacher named Timothy Negan. And, you know, these are real campaigns. These are people who are not just sort of running to raise issues, but are running because they actually think that they might stand a chance against some of these people, some of the Mayor Emanuel's allies. And I know that all of the endorsements that the CTU has made, they plan on putting real resources into those races. So, without sort of initial polling data, it's very hard to tell whether or not these races actually stand a chance, but just on the ground, these campaigns are real and seem to be decently organized.
Yeah, and there's and there are, you know, hopefully there's still a chance, hopefully to me, that Rahm will not be reelected, but a lot of movements and unions and individual activists are putting their efforts more into the aldermanic races, just because with that $10 million, you know, it is really a long shot to get the mayor out of office. So there's the grassroots collaborative, or their 501c4 organization, and then another, there's a few different coalitions of unions and faith-based groups and community groups that are really actively working to get a more independent city council, and specifically endorsing and campaigning for independent candidates in a number of different wards. And I mean, there's just one that I think is fun to mention, and I'm not sure, in the 10th ward, Olga Bautista, who's one of the activists leading the struggle against Petco, which, you know, I like bringing up that issue in particular because Rahm tries to spin himself as this champion of the environment, and that's one of several issues where he's actually bad on the environment, you know, and is actually to some degree protecting the Koch brothers, of all things. That's Petcoke is petroleum coke. It's, you know, this really toxic waste from oil refining, and there's a lot more of it in the area because the BP oil refinery in Whiting, Indiana, is refining Canadian tar sands oil, which produces more Petcoke than normal oil. So anyway, there's been over the past year and a half this big battle over piles of Petcoke rising on the southeast side, like literally these huge piles of toxic dust. And so there's been the city, I'll make this quick, you can talk for an hour about Petcoke probably, but the city passed these, you know, really pretty lax regulations against Petcoke and tried to make it look like this big stand they were taking, when in reality it was pretty much protecting the Koch brothers, who happen to own the Koch brother Koch Industries, which happens to own the Petcoke facility. So anyway, I mean, this is just one example of, you know, what I think is an exciting independent candidacy. One of the local activists who's really led the struggle to try to ban Petcoke and really made it an issue that even the state and city politicians took on in the first place. She's running against John Koch, who's, you know, one of the entrenched one-time aldermen. So, I mean, I won't talk about any more specific races, but I think more generally, on one hand, you know, it is exciting, and I think it's an encouraging thing that people are really trying to change the makeup of city council, but, you know, it also shows just how disheartening the political situation is in Chicago, because a lot of ordinances, even now, even with the rubber stamp city council that we have, there's been plenty of decent ordinances that actually have a majority of city council support, but they still don't get passed if the mayor doesn't want them to pass, because they get put in a committee and never called for a vote. You know, it's pretty rare, and of course the mayor can veto ordinances too. So, you know, I don't mean to take the wind out of these efforts to remake city council, but it's a long road to try to change the politics in the city, you know, alderman by alderman, because even if you had 26 great aldermen, you know, they still couldn't necessarily change anything. So, yeah, I mean, that's just the reality. You know, it really is a fiefdom in a lot of ways.
And sometimes aldermen, even when you do have a majority of the city council, it might not be all that much of an effort to peel off one or two or three aldermen off of that caucus, and then voila, you're back to square one. This was certainly the case regarding the big box ordinance that was passed in 2009, I think, regarding increasing of wages for Walmart and Target employees in the city of Chicago, which then Mayor Richard M. Daley actually saw a vote and actually saw it defeated to his, or actually saw it passed to his dismay, by a margin of, I think it was something like 28 to 22, and wound up then exercising his veto. It turns out it was the only time in 21 years in office they actually exercised a veto against an ordinance. And then they was to able to convince three aldermen to actually jump ship and oppose something they had originally voted for. So yes, there's that threat as well that has to be kept in mind here. Let's move on to the mayor's race, though. That is quite a lot to have to hoe, and especially where there is, we now have, I believe the number is 10 people who have now submitted in candidacies for running for the mayor's race in Chicago. Only 80 days until February 24th, 2015, which is when the mayoral election will take place in Chicago. Let's handicap this a little bit. Talk to me about who some of the names of who you think are leading candidates, and also is it possible that someone could actually challenge Rahm Emanuel, maybe force him to a runoff? Thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, everyone probably knows the leading contenders in the mayor's race, and probably everyone knows too that if no one gets more than 50%, it goes into a runoff. So mm-hmm. Essentially all the opposition candidates are working together, sort of, to get the mayor into a runoff. So I mean, I think it does seem pretty obvious at this point that Chuy Garcia would be the lead, the top contender, and then Bob Fioretti, one of the probably the most outspoken alderman in the city council, member of the Progressive Caucus, and the polls have showed this too, would be the next one up. And then there's, this other, a number of other candidates. Majority of the candidates are, the other candidates are African-American, which is significant since Mayor Emanuel's ratings are extremely low in the African-American community, but then also, the actual population of Black residents in Chicago has really dropped over the years. And then there's, of course, the issue of voter turnout, too. I mean, I think, most elections, it'll really come down to voter turnout and how many of Rahm's people come out to vote, and, more importantly, how many people who hate Rahm come out to vote, or at least dislike him, or, want him out of office. I mean, that would be a combination of people who actually are mobilized by and want to vote for one of the opponents, and I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that don't really know anything about Fioretti or Chuy Garcia that don't like Rahm. So probably the biggest question is how many of those people will come out to vote and vote against Rahm. I mean, the way things often go is, especially those people who aren't particularly inspired or knowledgeable about any of the opponents, they might be disgusted with how things are going in the city, but apathy is a pretty strong force. And, of course, it's no coincidence that the election's in February, when there's a good chance it'll be bad weather, and, a lot of people probably just won't go to the polls. So, I mean, that'll be the big challenge for the opponents, is getting people out to vote. Because if someone went door-to-door and, forced everyone to vote, I think then Rahm would have a pretty tough time, because his, the polls and just the word you hear on the street shows that he's very unpopular.
That was a panel at the Chicago Book Expo with Carrie Leiderson and Micah Utrecht at the Chicago Teacher Strike. The full audio of the panel, including a question and answer session, is available online at the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. Next, we'll hear another Chicago Book Expo panel featuring Rick Perlstein, the author of the book The Invisible Bridge: The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, comparing the Nixon and Reagan eras and the transition between the two. The panel was also moderated by Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Stepinchik.
Let me begin by actually asking about the title, The Invisible Bridge. What do you mean by that?
Well, it comes from a very interesting quotation, spoken to Richard Nixon by, of all people, Nikita Khrushchev, when Nixon was in the Soviet Union in 1959, and gave his famous kitchen debate set up by William Safire. Khrushchev told him, gave him some advice, political advice: if the people think that there's an invisible river down there, don't tell them it's not there, build an invisible bridge. In other words, bolt. And in a sense, my book is about the history of political bolt. And it starts in 1973. When several converging factors joined to kind of break the confidence of what had seen itself previously as God's chosen nation, the nation that had defeated Hitler, that had built the great American middle class, that had rose like a colossus and became the mighty economic powerhouse of the world. And those three factors were, of course, losing the Vietnam War, Watergate, in which people turned on their TVs in the summer of 1973 and saw White House official after White House official revealing themselves as little better than mafia associates, and the energy crisis, which most famously kind of hit its peak with the Arab oil embargo of October of 1979, 1973, but even started quite a bit earlier that spring, when people were talking about the possibility of gas rationing over the Memorial Day weekend, and there was discussion of not only canceling auto races, but of extinguishing the eternal flame at the tomb of John F. Kennedy because it wasted energy. So America's really in trouble, but and we remember the 70s as a very kind of dark and lugubrious time. But I also try and recover a sense of real civic energy that was going on then. People were really beginning to think hard, even at the level of popular culture, about what it would mean to not see ourselves as the world's policemen, to begin to do things like conserving energy, not putting our leaders on pedestals. And I'm thinking of, for example, on the level of popular culture, a show like MASH, right? Most popular show, and if you think about it, it's a very subversive idea. It takes the traditional American narrative, the kind of John Wayne narrative, and just turns it on its head. The heroes are the insubordinate doctors who refuse to distinguish between the North Koreans and the South Koreans, think that the American military mission is wasteful and foolish. And the villain is the spit-and-shine officer, Frank Burns, who's the butt of every joke because he's always following orders and he's patriotic and dares to believe what the government is telling him. And what I narrate in this book, which covers the years 1973 to 1976, is a kind of a debate going on within the culture about this new vision of patriotism, about challenging our leaders, about throwing down the idols, and this more old-fashioned version of patriotism represented by Ronald Reagan, who challenges Gerald Ford in 1976 for the Republican presidential nomination and almost does something unprecedented, which is take the nomination away from a sitting president.
And so the focus of those years, it sounds like, is emblematic on the focus of this transition where you had the kind of old school Republican guard exemplified by Nixon and now changed into the kind of the new standard that's exemplified by Reagan.
Right.
Fair
enough
to say?
Part of it is the continued rise, which is a kind of documented in a series of three books and soon to be four that I've written of the rise of the right in the Republican Party and the takeover of the conservative movement. It's building up its own internal independent political infrastructure. Figures like Richard Viguerie, the conservative fundraiser, the beginnings of Christian evangelical right. One of the most dramatic things I narrate in the book, the same school year as the Boston busing crisis, which is much more familiar. I talk about the textbook crisis in West Virginia, Kanawha County, West Virginia, in which the school board institutes what a bunch of fundamentalist preachers say are secular humanist satanic textbooks because they ask students to read people like James Baldwin. Have study questions like that compare the Greek myth Androcles and the lion and Daniel in the lion's den. In other words, putting Greek myth on the level of revealed Christian revelation. This movement becomes so intense that the anti-textbook activists end up dynamiting the school board, which would be a very interesting local conflict, but it becomes historic and a national issue because a brand new think tank, which has been established in Washington, sends down representatives to help these guys in their movement, in their legal defense, and that group is called the Heritage Foundation.
Now, that actually, you mentioned a phrase that kind of strikes, you really, really don't think about it, especially since you're talking about two Republican Party presidents, Nixon and Reagan. And yet you talk about the rise of the right.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's like, and then and in some ways it sounds kind of jarring, but then again, not necessarily so, especially given the fact that Richard Nixon, both Noam Chomsky and Michael Moore have described him and described Richard Nixon as our last liberal president. And it's kind of, as weird as that sounds, Given the policies that he did in office, it's understandable. Just a quick rundown of the list. The Environmental Protection Agency was founded. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, was founded. The Earned Income Tax Credit was established. The War on Cancer was established. The Fair Labor Standards Act saw a raise of 40% of American wages during the time when Nixon was president. So, yeah, as weird as, you know...
A corporate tax bill, which was the most regressive, an anti-regressive.
Yeah.
Well, but they're wrong still.
Okay, explain.
Presidents do not pick the policies and the laws that they sign from a catalog. They have to act in the political context that they're given. And the political context that Richard Nixon was given was a Democratic legislature that was basically dominated by liberals in a time in which the political center of gravity was far to the left than it is now. And, you know, I saw at the Nixon Library, a friend of mine went there a couple weeks ago and pointed out that one of the bills that they celebrate him for signing, because there's two things kind of the Nixon Foundation celebrates. One is they have people like Ann Coulter give speeches, and the other is that Nixon was this great liberal who, you know, like did wonderful things for blacks and women. But one of the bills that they were celebrating that he signed was an environmental bill that passed Congress something like by 425-10, right? So the fact of the matter is, if you want to know what Richard Nixon wanted to accomplish ideologically, you look at what he did after he won his 49th state landslide in 1972, which I write about in my book, Nixon Land. His budget for FY 1974, which Newsweek called the most important American political document since the New Deal, basically was recognizably what we would later call Reaganism. It sought to completely dismantle the Great Society and the war on poverty. He said in his memoir that basically his goal for his second term would be to fulfill the conservative mandate he'd been given in the election. Of course, that didn't happen. Richard Nixon didn't become Reagan because of the intervening troubles of that year involving Watergate. Ronald Reagan himself was responsible for some very liberal legislation that he signed, the most liberal abortion bill in the country. In 1967.
While he was governor of California?
Yes. Okay. And he said he was fooled into signing it, although, as you can see in my book, that's kind of questionable. He presided over several tax increases. But again, he was facing a very liberal legislature in California, and he wanted to get things done, and he wanted to be seen as a man of accomplishment. So, again, it's more complicated than that. And the fact of the matter is, in the case of Richard Nixon, what he really bequeathed to the country that was lasting, and this is what my second book, Nixon Land, is about, is a certain kind of discourse of cultural resentment on behalf of the white middle class. The idea that these liberal snobs have it in for you, the kind of message we hear, not only from, not too often these days, Sarah Palin, but, for example, a figure like Antonin Scalia, right, who last year there was a Supreme Court decision. And the question was it legal to execute, was cruel and unusual punishment to execute someone who was mentally retarded? And the facts of the case involved a person whose score on intelligence tests were, you know, 2 or 3 points above the threshold for mental retardation. But the expert witnesses pointed out that it was still within the margin of error, and so on, et cetera, et cetera. And basically, Antonin Scalia said, are you going to listen to the common sense of the American people, good, stout-hearted Americans like you and me, or these college professors? And that's the kind of discourse or reaction that Richard Nixon truly bequeathed to the nation, which was so important to the rise of conservative hegemony. Ronald Reagan made his own contributions, but that was Richard Nixon's signal contribution.
So if it turns out that that Nixon and Reagan were, I guess, victims of circumstance, as it were, but nonetheless, it sounds like that maybe ideologically they weren't all that far apart. Is that fair to say? Are they closer to the mark?
One of the most fascinating things I discovered in my research for this most recent book, The Invisible Bridge, was Ronald Reagan's reaction to Watergate. Alone among prominent politicians, he supported Richard Nixon to the end because he kind of divided the world into good people and bad people. And he simply classed Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew, too, by the way, as the good guys. So when he was asked on April 30th, when Richard Nixon gave a big speech saying, well, I've investigated Watergate, and it turns out it was all those people over there, and I've gotten rid of them, and so taking care of the problem. Ronald Reagan's response was that the Watergate conspirators weren't criminals at heart, and that was a shame that they had to go to jail. He said very similar things about Spiro Agnew. He said, in America, you're innocent until proven guilty. Of course, that same week, he also spoke of an accused cop killer and said he deserved to get the electric chair, even though he hadn't been convicted yet. So it's, again, good guys and bad guys. Somehow, Gerald Ford fell on the bad side of the ledger. So it's fascinating to see that even though when Richard Nixon was president, he supported the Nixon-Kissinger policy of detente, in other words, negotiating with the Soviet Union. As soon as Ford became president, he attacked it with a vengeance, and that was kind of a big part of why he...
this is Ford you're talking about? Ford attacked détente.
No. Reagan attacked détente once Ford was president.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about it was Ford was a pretty darn conservative figure, too. He basically made his mark as president by vetoing basically every bill. He vetoed 55 bills. And the idea was he was going to stop inflation by cutting this reckless spending that Congress was doing. But somehow he got tabbed as this kind of liberal interloper. And one of the stories I tell in the book is how Ronald Reagan's policy differences were not particularly different from Ronald Reagan, but their affect, their emotional tone was extremely different. And... Ronald Reagan, when he ran for president in 1976, did a great job of kind of talking about the compromises that are required when you actually are the president and actually are governing as sellouts. So he did a great job of sort of speaking in opposition.
That was Rick Perlstein, author of the book Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, recorded on December 6, 2014 at the Chicago Book Expo. The full audio of the panel, including a question and answer session, is available online at the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more, listen to past episodes of From the Trenches, and get involved in making media and help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indiemedia.org. I'm Kimmy Adidokun. Special thanks to John K. Wilson and the staff of the Chicago Book Expo. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode of From the Trenches.